On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Podcast Magazine takes readers into the lives of today's leading podcasters and beyond the microphone of the shows fans love. Each month, Podcast Magazine's dedicated writers share personal interviews, exclusive categorical charts, industry happenings, and more. This month's issue features a special sit-down with Teray, who shares how to unlock the doors to success and find purpose in life and career. Get a free lifetime subscription while you can at podcastmagazine.com.
Is there a character on the show who you feel a little closer to, a little more in love with than the others? Is there a favorite child?
Wow, not favorite child to write. Jesus.
Okay. Come on. Every family's got the favorite child.
I think Sam and Lionel are probably like the extroverted and introverted extremes of my personality. And Lionel specifically, because he's gay and Black and is sort of navigating all of that, is dealing with a lot of things that I very specifically dealt with. You know, one of them is the assumption that Black people, that Black men in particular, won't accept me because I'm gay, and having to get over that assumption and realizing that that assumption sometimes is true, but also sometimes was blocking me from connections, you know, even though it was sort of like a self-defensive thing. You know, Lionel has to go through that realization. I had to go through that realization.
Justin Simeon is the creator, writer, producer, and director of Dear White People, one of the illest shows on Netflix, which came from a movie, which is one of the dopest movies that came out in the last 10 years. Justin is brilliant and hysterical and one of the central voices in the modern Black cinematic golden era. I called him at home so we could maintain appropriate social distancing, and we got deep about his show and the movie that he's working on now, a horror film called Bad Hair. This, of course, is the Patreon era of Torre Show. So if you want to hear the whole episode of me and Justin going into his film background, his horror movie, and everything else, go to patreon.com/Torre Show and support our growing team, and you'll get full access to the Wednesday episodes and Friday Patreon exclusives with people like Malcolm Gladwell, ZZ Packer, Morris Day, Lil Yachty, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and more. Now, it's Justin Simeon on Torre Show. So how is it for you right now under Corona quarantine? Are you stuck in the house 23 hours a day like all the rest of us?
Yes, it's weird. I mean, like I'm a homebody. And I'm an introvert, but this is ridiculous, you know? It really is. But I think, like, I don't know, me and my partner, Rick, like, I feel like we're uniquely built for it because we both like staying at home anyway. Mm. But I think the thing is more the existential side of it that messes with me because, you know, I'm still running the writer's room for Dear White People. I'm still editing my movie. Like, I'm still acting as if, you know, all of these deadlines are terribly important. But when I'm not busy, like, you know, I sort of go down the rabbit hole of, like, what is life? Will shows ever come out again? What will my career be like? You know, what is this world that I'm suddenly putting stuff into? What is that world going to be, you know?
Yeah, right now, at least, it doesn't feel relevant to make a comedy or something that, you know, looks at the nitty gritty of society. Like, I find myself only watching like horror films because I'm like, that's the only thing that actually makes any sense.
Well, I got one of those coming out too, so that's good. I mean, the thing about Dear White People that is helpful is, I mean, we talked about it and we were like, okay, we're not making a coronavirus season. Like that would be, that's too much. But
even as a creator, what would that look like? Like everybody's in their own homes, zooming to each other. Like that would be terrible television anyway.
And honestly, I have no idea what it would look like because we're still at the beginning of it. You know what I mean? Like I don't know what society is going to be. I mean, this is one of those moments that, you know, I think, you know, especially people in my generation, we sort of like went through 9/11, but you know, we've only watched documentaries about like World War II and like, you know, these sort of major moments in history where the entire globe had to change their habits because of some crisis. We're living through that right now. So, you know, part of it is I as an artist, I want to comment on the world we're living in, especially with a show like Dear White People. And I'm not sure what that world's going to be, but the one thing that we do that we were able to identify is that, you know, so much of Dear White People from the movie to the show is about identity versus self. And usually those identities that these kids have to carry and that, of course, we all have to carry are really tied to capitalism and our productivity. And I feel like everybody's having that crisis right now of like, what am I, you know, if I can't produce in the normal way that I've sort of been geared to do my whole life. So in that way, there's a parallel, but it's still very strange. It's still very strange. It's like we're making pop culture references, and I'm sure I don't know if that chain will even be open or if that celebrity will be relevant. I don't know.
I mean, it is really interesting. It is really honest to say that the show Dear White People is about identity versus self, because they seem to be constantly being pulled in the direction of, here's what I want from my day or my life or this struggle in the life of the school, be it, you know, as a woman, as a person who wants to date a white person, as a gay person trying to figure that out, whatever it is. But then the pull of the community is dragging you in the other direction, right? And the groupthink. And that was really present for me when I was in college a very long time ago. So I know, it's a really honest and deep struggle that all of us are going through at that time in our life and beyond. In the work world, you still have that. But when you're in college, you are really feeling that in a very tangible way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's to me why college is such a great microcosm for film and TV, because it really is sort of like society at large kind of condensed into this space where you sort of know all the rules, you know, you kind of get the hierarchy of a school without having to be explained it. And I felt like we could really get into it. And I have to say, you wrote a book about post-racial America that was very influential. Your book and the book Why Do All the Black Kids Sit Together in the Cafeteria, those two books together really helped me sort of figure out what I needed to say with that first film. And, you know, what it kept getting to for me is that black people, or, you know, people of color, any sort of like community that's on the margins, that isn't the default, you know, we have to play this sort of constant game of doublethink, where we have to be aware of how we're being perceived either by our own people or by the dominant culture. And, you know, we don't really have the same opportunities to figure out who we really are, because we are constantly trying to survive, you know, other people's kind of needs from us. And it's from within the community and without the community, because, you know, you especially feel this as a filmmaker, or when I'm doing a TV show, is like, you know, if I was a white person, there would be, you know, I could sort of be a little bit more, true to the sort of pure artistic intent. But, you know, as a queer black man, like I have to think about like the political ramifications for what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I have to think about like, how is this going to be perceived by my people, by white people? How is it going? You know, how is the skin color ratio going in the cast? Mm. Are we saying something that we don't mean about this group of people? You know, there's like all of these different like voices in the head because, you know, we're trying to overcome societal oppression as well as be entertained.
No, it's really interesting that you are so tangibly aware that the work does not function in a vacuum. It touches up against all these political ideas and identities. I mean, even when you're down to talking about like the skin color ratio, like you're casting and you're thinking very consciously about, do we have a good ratio of light to dark to medium? Like, how does that even play out?
I mean, it's tricky because, you know, I know just from my upbringing and my understanding of storytelling that, like, you got to always do what's right for the story. But you don't, especially when it comes to Black content, you know, there's all these sort of subtle messages that you may not even mean to sort of be transmitting, but that can crop up, you know, and you have to think about things like, okay, is every light-skinned person, and sometimes this is just by coincidence, but you have to think about, like, is every light-skinned person portrayed one way and every dark-skinned person portrayed a different way? And how many do we have of each, you know, sort of subgroup? There are, you know, there are so many other subgroups of Black as well and cultural identities within the African diaspora. And it's like, you want to make sure that if there is one version of one person, that they are not sort of saying something representative about that whole group of people. And I learned this, you know, I felt this instinctively making the movie, but I really got it on the road with the movie, you know, when I started doing Q&As and stuff. And, you know, I'd walk into one room where the movie was too Black for a group of people. Then I'd walk into another room where it wasn't Black enough or it wasn't gay enough or, you know, what am I saying about... I remember someone was taking me to task because of the moment when Sam takes her hair down in the movie. And it's like, so what am I saying? Am I saying that like European standards of beauty or freedom? And it's just like, you know, it's a minefield of messages because, you know, we have so few stories told to us and told for us. And there are some blind spots that are just very abundant and it's very hard to try to get something across, be entertaining, be artistic, but avoid those minefields for, you know, the people that I'm actually making this thing for.
So let's talk about the movie. I want to talk about the journey to the television show, which starts with the movie, which started with an incredible trailer, but just, you know, not self-servingly at all. Can we talk in a little more detail about how my book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, inspired what you're talking about? Because I'm incredibly honored to hear you say that. And just to try to understand a little bit more the connection for you there.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it really began, I was in, you know, my Black student union in college, having a conversation with my Black friends that I just thought was really interesting and that I had never really seen in movies and TV before. And at that time, you know, 2005, what was considered Black film, you know, wasn't necessarily like that Spike Lee, Robert Townsend's, you know, social commentary thing. It was more broad sort of, you know, entertainment, escapism stuff. And I felt like, wow, I want to make a smart kind of conversational movie about the issues, you know, about what it feels like to be Black right now. And I never had the benefit of being Black among all Black people. You know, I always found myself being a Black face in white spaces and sort of, you know, walking that line. And, you know, particularly at that time, you know, especially after Obama was elected president, I felt like I felt in my bones that I was still sort of subject to societal oppression, but it felt very taboo at the time to say that or to talk about that because everybody was in this, you know, post-racial kind of fantasy after he was elected. And your book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, really like... It gave me permission, honestly, to articulate, no, wait a minute, racism is very much still alive and well and afoot. And in fact, like, it's even scarier because it's so subversive now. And so few people want to admit it and talk about it honestly. And I think, you know, the vibe of that first movie, which was sort of, pre-Black Lives Matter.
Yep.
The vibe of that movie was very like, you know, are we allowed to say this? You know what I mean? It was sort of like we were seeing characters in that movie talk about things that I think at the time, a lot of people of color were saying in sort of huddles and sort of privately amongst ourselves, but we weren't really saying it out loud in front of mixed company. And a lot of that, you know, sort of the permission to go there and to admit that what I was experiencing actually was very much still racism. I don't know. I just remember reading that book and having this kind of sick euphoria of like, yes, yes, this is exactly what I've been saying. Oh, well, this is exactly how I feel.
Thank you so much. You know, I mean, there was nothing in the content that suggested I am afraid or I am tiptoeing into this material. The film itself, starting with the trailer, was very bold, was very self-assured, was very much comfortable with the notion of we are dealing with blackness in a complex way and we are funny and we are badass. And it reminded me of the way Spike roared into the public consciousness with, you know, an audacious public statement that was full of its own artistic confidence, right? And confidence in the point that it wanted to make. And I remember the first time I saw your trailer online, and it seemed artistically, visually, very post-Spike, but also like in your face, taking you back to school, funny, brilliant, like, I was like, oh, I have to see that. And a lot of people said the same thing. Just talk about the confidence that you, because you said, you know, that you needed to find the, let's say, approval to feel that way publicly. But then when you go to make the piece, you were like, yeah, it felt to me like I'm banging my chest. I feel good about this point.
Well, I'm glad that that's how that came across. No, I mean, you know, it's sort of when I say the confidence to say it, I mean, it's sort of the way art is supposed to function. You know, I think really great storytelling gives you permission to feel things and to admit things and to say things and to articulate things that, you know, you maybe felt but never had the words for before. That's what your book did for me. And so I wanted to do that as confidently as I could with the movie. And, you know, I had also had a lot of time to think about it. You know, the first thing I wrote for Dear White People was in 2005. We didn't make that movie until 2013. So there were a lot of ideas. You know, there was a lot going on in that movie. And one of the things that I really was passionate about, because I'm, you know, I'm a student of cinema. I love cinema. And, you know, especially at that time, I didn't feel like all of our stories were necessarily being told in a cinematic way. So it was really important for me to not only come with a new conversation, but also a sort of style that would kind of reflect that newness. And the idea of putting black faces in these sort of cinematic frames that, you know, whether you're aware of it or not, you only really see with white people in them. It was something that I thought was really important. You know, I remember when I saw Do the Right Thing in high school, and just was like, literally the light bulb went off. It's like, oh, we can do black stories like this too. Mm. You know, we can sort of pull from the French New Wave and we can pull from Altman and we can pull from Bergman and we can pull from Kubrick and tell black stories. Like, that was a big light bulb moment for me. And I wanted to sort of continue in that direction, which is, you know, whether you catch it or not, that movie is quoting so many classic films, but with black faces in it.
Like what?
A big one is Metropolis, the Fritz Lang film from the 20s, which is so much about, you know, class rebellion and sort of oppression. You know, the scene when they're in the movie theater talking about, you know, the Tyler Perry movie, you know, that's a direct visual quote from a scene from Metropolis. There are visual quotes from Barry Lyndon, which is one of my favorite Kubrick movies, particularly around Troy, who I felt was, you know, trying to exist in both of these worlds. There's visual quoting from Bergman, particularly from Persona, when it comes to Coco. And there's just a lot of moments like that scattered throughout the film that really are for me, but I think subconsciously tell you that you're watching something that's new, but also knowledgeable about what came before it. I very much wanted to show that black stories belonged in the center of cinema, you know, not just sort of like a sort of niche genre of cinema. Like, we belonged in the center of it.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
We'll get back to the show in 1 second, but there are things we all look back on in life and say, how could I have gotten it so wrong? That haircut you liked in high school, wearing multiple polo shirts at once, donating to Kony 2012, remember that? That one person you loved that one time, you know the one. We always get things wrong, that's just life, but there are things we can get right on the first try, like shopping for life insurance. Because if you use Policy Genius, you'll get it right the first time. They make finding life insurance a breeze. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers and find the best price. You could save more than $1,500 a year using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. And once you apply, they handle all the paperwork and make it easy. And they don't just make life insurance easy. They can help you find home insurance, auto insurance, disability insurance, all kinds of things. So even if you look back on your triple denim days in distress, and I know you do, you'll never be distressed about life insurance with Policy Genius. In just a few minutes, you can find the best price and apply at policygenius.com. Look, we all get things wrong from time to time, but we can get life insurance right and help you sleep at night with Policy Genius. If you love Toure's show and you miss the days of me talking about politics on MSNBC, and really, who doesn't? Then check out my other podcast, Democracy-ish, where I sit with Danielle Moody Mills and argue and strategize about the 2020 race from a Black and progressive perspective.
I know that Republicans, when the blame falls squarely on their shoulders, like to say shit like, now is not the time to blame. Right. Oh, motherfucker, I have all the time. I have all the time in the world
I'm at home.
To blame right now.
I got time to blame.
But I'm at home.
You can find Democracy-ish wherever podcasts are streamed. All right, back to Toure's show.
So when you make a movie
That was fantastic. I was there the first weekend. I went to see it on the Upper East Side of New York, and the crowd was very black, very excited, yelling at the screen in the way that you want. So it was the perfect experience for that movie. It's called Dear White People. So this, the title is literally addressing white people, but the movie is not, suffused with the white gaze, right? It is, it has definitely rejected the white gaze, and it is focused on the concerns of the black people, which is sort of an interesting, almost sleight of hand that you pull there, right? And it's the same in the television show. This is not black culture for white people. This is definitely black culture for black people.
Right. Absolutely.
How do you do that?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's funny because the title sort of, I always hear the story of both white and black people or people of other races saying, you know, well, you know, the title made me think it was one thing, but then I watched it and I realized it was another thing. I mean, I don't know. Part of it was, I thought it was, there was something fun about doing a satire that has a bit of a misnomer title. But also because the question of is something like Dear White People reverse racist, you know, which is a ridiculous question. But that question really is one of the driving narrative drivers in the movie and the show. You know, Sam's radio show within the film and TV series Dear White People, where she's challenging sort of white notions, you know, whether or not that is okay is sort of a big to do in both iterations of it. So that's part of why the title is that way. But also, as I began to work on it more and more thematically, I realized that one of the one of the poisons or one of the setbacks of being a person of color in this country is that we always feel like we have to respond to whiteness, you know, whether it is white fear of us or being underestimated or being overestimated or, you know, it always, try as we might to avoid it, at some point, the white mass popular opinion about any given thing does affect us. And, but we're trying to find space to be our authentic selves. And we're trying to find space to sort of just live and to just breathe. But we have to keep coming up against, you know, having to answer to white people on a variety of topics and issues. And so for me, it's sort of, it was a statement about that. It was kind of like an underhanded statement about that as well.
You talk about being a student of film, and it's clear that you are. Can you talk about some of your, like, do you have a top five favorite filmmakers of all time?
Oh my gosh. I mean, Kubrick is definitely up there.
He's amazing.
I mean, I just remember seeing Eyes Wide Shut and hating it. I remember seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey actually several times and just totally hating it. And then watching Eyes Wide Shut and not getting it, hating it. But I kept watching it. And by the time I got to the end of that movie, I was so riveted that, you know, when you get to the part where Nicole Kidman is like, well, you know what we should do now? Fuck. I like it just knocked me over. And I was like, how did he do that? How did he turn me from bored to riveted? And did he do that on purpose? And it just sort of rabbit holed me into like analyzing his films. And now 2001 A Space Odyssey is literally my favorite movie of all time. I think it is one of the best movies made by an American filmmaker.
Hal, open the pod door.
Like, I know. I watched it so many times with so much loathing for it. You know, no one was more surprised than me. He's a magician and a master.
It's amazing how that opening scene with the monkeys and then the future technology sort of explodes into the moment, how that has been taken and parodied and redone in commercials and other movies and The Simpsons and on and on.
Yeah.
Like it's like moments in The Matrix are just like taken into the culture and like just sort of disseminated all over the place.
Absolutely. I mean, the crazy thing about Kubrick is like watching his movies suddenly fills in so many blanks for The Simpsons, actually, specifically, because they reference Kubrick movies so much. And I, you know, as a kid and stuff, I was like, oh, that's funny. But now I actually get, oh, no, that's a very specific reference. Got it. So, I mean, Kubrick is really up there for me. I also just really love Bergman. I mentioned Fritz Lang before. I'm a huge, I watch, I love his films. I love Billy Wilder movies. Of course I love, you know, Spike and Townsend, and all of my contemporaries. I don't know if I've hit five yet, but
I think we're at seven, but that's fine.
John Frankenheimer, Bob Fosse, I don't know.
Altman, Robert Altman.
I love Altman. Yeah.
It does seem like there's a black visual culture golden age going on. And I think you're definitely like right in the middle of it. I feel like there's more black people behind the camera and in front of the camera creating really great authentic art, you know, in movies, in television. I think there's more than ever, and creating more authentic, inspiring art than ever. Does it feel like that to you?
Yeah. I mean, it absolutely does. It feels like there's this little window of opportunity that has, you know, creased open, and it's cool to see. It really is. And what's also been really rewarding for me is people who were just starting, you know, when I made Dear White People, the movie, who are absolutely flourishing right now. And, you know, directors who, you know, maybe their first thing was doing my show and now they're doing their own shows. And it's fucking awesome. It really is. Because like when I made the movie, part of it was like, I was making the content that I was starving for and that I wanted to see out there. And, you know, I love making movies and I love making the show, but it also is nice to just sit down and watch it and not have to make it in order to consume it. So,
when you sit down and watch, like, what do you like to watch that's out like now?
Well, you know, specifically, like, I'm really excited about what's happening with Boomerang, the season two and with 20s. I love Atlanta, of course. Mm. I mean, Atlanta is just, I just love it. I love the way he thinks. I love the way that show works.
So, okay, wait. So what is your favorite episode of Atlanta?
Oh my God, Teddy Perkins, obviously.
Teddy Perkins is extraordinary and I love Teddy Perkins. But for me, the journey of the barbershop episode is extraordinary.
That was really good.
And it's like they're like one, really two for me, but like just the journey and the meaning of like, yeah, you'll go anywhere to get a haircut, right? And like, you know,
yeah.
And just the journey of like this happens and this happens and this happens. And it just is this natural sort of pull through the world. I mean, you know, and Teddy Perkins is extraordinary. It's like a little movie.
Teddy Perkins messed me up, okay, like for several days. and whenever art can do that to me, I'm extremely appreciative.
Wait, when the murder happens or when he expresses admiration for Michael Jackson's dad and Richard Williams and...
Okay, first of all, the whole way through, I was messed up, but specifically when we met the dude in the basement, like I wasn't ready for Black Teddy stuck in the basement. I really wasn't. And you know, it was just very bold, and he went there. And the thing that's so great about it is that, like, you know, I know exactly the conundrum that he's bringing to the forefront, because any Black person thinks about these things all the time. You know, our heroes who, you know, inspired us when we were coming up or as kids or whatever, and, you know, their tragic ends, like, how do you reconcile those two things? Because, you know, especially for Black folks, like, our heroes make us feel like we can get out of bed. That sometimes, like, you know, Michael Jackson or Bill Cosby or, you know, any of the fallen heroes, like, you know, they're the reason why so many of us thought we, you know, had the right to even do anything in the world. And to see them sort of, you know, stumble or you know, we don't have to go all the way in there, but you know, you know, have these sort of public, very serious scandals.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash
all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
It's very destabilizing in a soulful level for black people in a way that is different than just when like your favorite movie star, you know, did something. And so it's like, I don't know. I went into a deep sunken place after that episode and I had to have some very, you know, some soul to soul conversations with myself, I love because like, you know, that's what art is supposed to do. And I love that black art is able to do that with more frequency now.
Well, you talk about the sunken place. If you could only watch one tonight, would you watch Get Out or Us?
Oh boy. I mean, I think Get Out just because it was so, I mean, Get Out is just perfection. It is so clean and perfect. And, you know, the other thing about Get Out is that it was revolutionary, in a lot of ways.
How?
And I think one thing that I thought, you know, I was working on my own little black horror movie at the time. It was just a script when I saw Get Out. And one of the things that I felt like, you know, and it was similar to when I read your book, actually. But what I didn't quite have words for before I saw Get Out was that, like, you know, horror films always speak to some real societal fear, you know.
Mm.
But, you know, whether we're talking about Body Snatchers or we're talking about, you know, Child's Play or we're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, typically those fears have a just inherent white people tint to them. Like it's, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. we all have these fears, but white people really get like, you know, Friday the 13th in a way that I don't know that, you know, black people just instinctively get the horror in that movie. And Get Out, the horror in Get Out was, you know, these sort of seemingly liberal people who, because of their performative liberalism, were actually blind to us, you know, these people who are so colorblind, they can't see that people of color are actually having a different experience. And you know, sort of falling, being prey to a system that works like that, but, you know, is in complete denial. Like, those are real, actual fears that haunt us in various ways. And to see that put in a movie and to put in the language of psychological thriller, I was like, wow, yes, this is where cinema has to go. Because, you know, as a black person, I've never sat through a horror movie and felt like it was speaking directly to my fears.
Mm.
And that was revolutionary. And, you know, I think the fact that he doesn't die in the end of the movie, it was revolutionary too. Because you're expecting him to get arrested at the end of the movie. I think that's the way it originally was, but they changed it to, well, it's, you know, his friend coming out the cop car to greet him. For me,
I prefer the other.
You prefer the darker ending.
I prefer the original ending that he ends up in prison. The cops come and arrest him. And, of course, the black man is doing the right thing. And of course, nobody believe. I mean, in that situation, who would believe that you were doing the right thing? And he goes to prison, and we know that he's right, but the world does not. I thought it was a teeny weeny bit of a cop out to have like Lil Rel show up and be like, "Oh my God, he's actually saved!" Like,
Well, I mean, you know, look, as a film goer. Not film goer. What am I talking about? As a person who loves, you know. I guess, challenging art, you know, I always love the tragic ending. You know, the tragic endings are always the best because they say something very truthful. But I'm going to be honest, as a person in the trenches making a black horror film right now, I'm not sure if audiences on the whole are ready for it. And I remember being in the theater of Get Out and feeling the tension of the black people in the audience and the release of that tension when it was Laurel in the cop car. That sort of triumphant feeling, because we always die in the horror movies, you know, there was something a little political about that I got when I was, you know, just from the experience of seeing it in a theater, I really felt that. And, you know, I think maybe the artist in me appreciates the darker ending, probably always.
Right.
But I also, you know, I think as filmmakers, like, we're part artists, but we're also like kind of part politician, because we're trying to like, we're making products for audiences to take into their daily lives. And I have to say, I get why they did it. I really do. The response to it, I thought, was really tremendous, and might have been just needed at that time. So I'm both sides on it.
Thanks so much to Justin for an epic interview, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Jerry Michael Smith, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montez, and Jason Reynolds. All of you, join us over at patreon.com/Toure Show for more from Justin, and get an extra episode every Friday only for Patreon subscribers. Toure Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Toure and on Instagram at Toure Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/Toure Show. Toure Show is written by me, Toure, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editors, Ryan Woodhull. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing people, because the man can't shut us down.